It's Monday, November 7th, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran. Now, today we have discussed the news from Calais, as authorities have reported having fulfilled their mission of emptying the infamous jungle camp, once home to upwards of 7,000 migrants and asylum seekers. The clearances began on the 26th of October, and from reports we're getting in now, the last shelter was destroyed on the 31st. A lot of people have spent a lot of time dissecting the internal politics and political symbolism surrounding the jungle camp, but today we've opted to widen the lens a little bit. We've invited Claudio Minca, the professor and head of cultural geography and the chair of a group at Wageningen University, and he's going to talk to us about these events. Claudio is perhaps the leading authority, along with people like Giorgio Agamben, on the politics of the camp, and he has written extensively about the topic. He's currently working on a project entitled The Geographies of the Camp in Europe, which is particularly focused not on Calais, but on the spatialities of contemporary refugee camps in northern Italy and also the Balkan region. Hi, Claudio. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Now, I wanted to start off, Claudio, by talking about the jungle and just getting your first impressions about what's happening there at the moment. This has been attempted before. Is the jungle finished? Will we see it resurface? What do you see happening?
It's difficult to say. The jungle has been there for a long time, and it's been almost institutionalized as a makeshift camp. It's become a site where people will pay a visit for a form of camp tourism. It's become also a sort of display of the French politics in terms of refugees and the desire not to take them on board, not to be in charge of them, right? So in many ways it shows a number of contradictions, but also the result of deliberate political intentions to abandon some of these migrants or asylum seekers to their own whereabouts and hope that they will disappear. But they didn't disappear, and now suddenly the French state decided to do something about it. In my experience, when I began studying makeshift camps, what happens, the action to cleanse the camp is very spectacular. It is announced in advance, weeks in advance. So the large majority of the residents in these camps disappears before. They just go away. And then you have action, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days of action. Things happen during those days. Some of these people are indeed taken somewhere else. But the majority normally actually reappears in different locations, and they create new forms of makeshift camps, right? It is a strange form of spatial intervention that has to do with a number of reasons, but mainly in this case with the desire to show that something can be done to restore order. In fact, probably the result will be there will be more disorder and more makeshift and spontaneous campings in different parts of France and Europe.
Can I ask you to, you talked about a number of paradoxes there, and one that I really liked you opened up with, the institutionalization of the makeshift. Can you unpack what you mean there? Because to many of our listeners, that will sound as a total contradiction in terms.
Yes, I think one of the things I've done in the past few months was to go along the Balkan route of the, it's called the refugee, there are different names, the refugee Balkan route, the Eastern route. But fundamentally, what I did with my colleagues, I went down to Idomeni, where probably the largest makeshift camp was still existent until the end of May. They were talking about 12 to 14,000 people. And that camp was the result of the fact that people coming from Greece Idomeni is in Greece indeed, were blocked at the border with Macedonia because of the establishment of a double fence, a wall, and the decision of the part of Macedonian authorities to block all the traffic. But that was actually quite a spontaneous and a lively encampment. People didn't want to go into regular camps. They really wanted to go to that border, and they were staying there as a form of protest, as a form of pressure against that decision. What you see in Calais, or what you used to see in Calais until recently, is quite different. Calais has been there for a couple of decades at this point, in different forms as a camp, as a terminal to different routes throughout Europe. And the aim of people arriving in Calais was to go to the UK. There's a colleague of mine who actually defined Calais as a sort of London slum, as an extension of London, as a sort of strange periphery that was established in French territories. And at the same time, anybody visiting Calais saw there was a sort of structure in that camp with different ethnic regions. I heard there was also some sort of a real estate market, people selling positions, restaurants, housings. There was lots of smuggling going on. And so in many ways, it was not only tolerated, but Calais was allowed to be a sort of a informal city with a degree of stability. And that stability was quite an extraordinary event, I think, very different from the usual makeshift camp. And I don't know if that is really a contradiction, because it seemed to me that, again, it was the result of the deliberate decision of the French state not to intervene. And I can say something more about this interplay between intervention and non-intervention on the part of the governments, but maybe that's for another question.
I really like this imagery of Calais as a slum of London. That's an impressive, I guess, metaphor, and also, you know, an understanding of its geography. A lot of people, a lot of scholars out there are making sort of parallel moves, whether it be with talking about, you know, stretching concepts from their original geographical locus to see how they play out in different contexts. And some people do it with the slum, other people do it with the ghetto or the prison. And you're trying to do that with the camp. And what specific purchase do you think that history, that historiography, that term gives us on what you're calling, I mean, along with Giorgio Agamben, the global nomos of our age? What's peculiar about it to you?
I use the camp as a form of analytics, as a way of understanding specific kind of spaces. Normally, in the work that I've been doing with my colleagues, we consider the camp as a space of exception, so a kind of space where the ordinary rules are somehow suspended. Some different regime, spatial-temporal regime, is present in the camp. And the second condition of the camp to exist, to me, is that it's a space that requalify specific subjects when they are included into the camp. So, for example, people arriving in the camp as migrants, they are numbered, they are qualified according to the system of registration, they are divided according to specific rules internal to the camp, and they are also managed as bodies that reflect precisely the logic of the camp that I mentioned before. So the camp has this peculiar structure, but of course there are many different manifestations of camps, and what we normally use in order to conceptualize them is this combination of custody and care. Camps normally are created to play this role as custodian, also protective institution and caring institution, but at the same way it's an institution that tends to control the people who are included into its political economy. And so I found the camp as a concept, but then the camp as a political institution, a very useful tool to analyze, for example, the way in which the whole refugee crisis, so-called refugee crisis, is managed. And if I can add one more thing about the makeshift camps related to the refugee crisis, I think that the majority of the makeshift camps have a very close relationship to the institutional camps, either because they are established just outside the institutional camp. One case that I studied in Northern Italy is a so-called hospitality camp for asylum seekers. And you have a jungle just outside the camp along the riverbank with people who either don't want to enter the camp or they're just waiting to enter the camp. And there's a whole kind of geography about people arriving in that area because they know there is a camp and because they know there is a jungle related to the camp. And we have many other cases in which this relationship is taking specific forms. What I find incredible is that in a time in which our territories are, you know, patrolled and monitored via GIS, you have these spontaneous spatial formations, spontaneous geographies that are appearing everywhere. And you have people who are roaming throughout the forest and the fields of Europe and abandoned to their roots, right, to their destinies. And this combination of control and abandonment is actually something crucial to understand the camp geographies today, I think.
Yeah, so you have this sort of linkage between custody and care, which to many people would be read as a hypocrisy, right? A deep and underlying either failure on behalf of the state to provide care, or the use of the rhetoric of care to enhance its custodial power and authority. Is that how listeners should be reading your work, or?
Well, you can read it that way. I think it's normally a bit more complicated than that, in a sense that even the first concentration camps established by the Third Reich were institution based on custody. And the idea was to protect specific subjects from either harming society or from being in danger of being vulnerable. There were forms of concentration of people that were actually established on a temporary basis, and then they were becoming very often permanent. Now, this custodian role of the camp has been there for a long time, and of course it was part of the rhetoric that allowed for these camps to be legitimate and to be managed as part of a broader politics. But at the same time, this tension between protection, care, and control is very much there in many of the institutions that have this characteristic. I would say probably some of the detention centers can be defined as camps precisely because of that.
So once the people who have been residing in the jungle and at Calais move on, do we see a dispersal of this type of geography? Do we see those sort of state logics and practices reappear elsewhere? I mean, we're already seeing the emergence of settlements, whether you call them camps, in Paris. Is that how the logic of your work extends and the sorts of dynamics that you're interested in exploring?
Certainly so. I mean, one of the things that we find particularly interested in our work in Serbia is that the people moving across Europe to reach either, you know, Germany or the UK, these are the major destinations, at least along the route that we are studying right now, they know very well the geographies of the camp. They are completely aware of how the institutions work, how they change their regime sometimes for being more a detention site than just a place for recovery. They know where the makeshift camps appear and disappear. They tweet all the time. And so there is a specific geography that is actually created by the migrants, by the refugees as well, right? And this is very interesting because we kind of resist this idea that there is a subject we call the refugee, because there are very complicated interaction between these geographies, the camp themselves, and the whole movements that we are witnessing right now in Europe. Now, the thing that we find also quite astonishing is that the majority of the hospitality camps for refugees that we visited in Serbia, and in part is also true in Italy, they're structured in a way that, on the one hand, they would like to register these people and so make them part of this system of camps and their own language and metrics, right? But on the other, they are aware that these people will disappear. So there's a constantly interplay between the attempt to include the refugees within the camp logic, right? To make them part of this political economy of the camp. But at the same time, there is a deliberate attempt to let them go. And this is happening all the time, right? Just in Italy last year, apparently more than 100,000 people disappeared, right? And the same thing is happening in Serbia. They give them some hospitality, they help them, they try to register them, but they know that the day after they will disappear, and they hope they go elsewhere, right? So this constant combination of support, protection, inclusion, but at the same time abandonment, you know, is something quite interesting in the function of the camps, because the camps have this huge role in producing precisely these geographies. Now, you mentioned Paris, but I visited recently Belgrade. There is a park right in the center of the city, close to the station, that now is called Afghan Park. And this is where everybody arrives. This is where they meet their smugglers. This is where the whole geography that we describe is organized and reorganized for the following trips. And sometimes the camps are included as part of these itineraries, right? So speaking to the authorities there, they already know that we'll double the number of camps by next year. And this will not go away. This is a specific geography that probably will remain and will become, in a strange way, a permanent presence in Europe.
Well, thanks, Claudio. You provide a fascinating insight to what seems to be, on the one hand, Europe's attempt to lay hold of and grasp, embrace the migrant population within it, and at the same time to let the chaos reign, right? And to let go and abandon populations, which is going to puzzle us, I think, for years to come. So thank you so much for coming on, and we hope to hear from you again in the future. For those of you interested in finding out more about Claudio's research, you can find links to his staff page and a sample of his work at our blog, 4mpodcast.com. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can access us through iTunes or Stitcher, and subscribe for updates on Twitter and Facebook. As always, if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature, or would like to post an audio rejoinder to something that's been said on a previous podcast, please send us an email at imes@uva.nm.